TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Monsanto versus Percy Schmeiser. In part one of this program, you heard the Canadian canola farmer Percy Schmeiser describe how the agrochemical giant Monsanto sued him when his canola crop was invaded by their genetically modified seed. For 50 years, Schmeiser planted canola seed that was bred by him and saved from harvest to harvest. When a neighbor used Monsanto GMO canola, Schmeiser's purebred line became contaminated. That's a fate he shares with an increasing number of organic or heirloom growers. Up to date, Monsanto has filed 150 lawsuits claiming illegal use of their patent. Now finally, farmers are fighting back. The Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association and others, representing over 300,000 individuals in the U.S. and Canada, filed a landmark suit to stop these lawsuits. As of January 2012, their suit is making its way through the U.S. court system. In the course of his multi-year battle with Monsanto, Percy Schmeiser became an international folk hero and recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, also called the Alternative Nobel Prize. He also came to the help of farmers and communities under attack. When I recorded him in November 2006, he had joined with the University of California, Berkeley microbiologist Ignacio Chapella. Chapella and Schmeiser have an important experience in common. In October 2000, Chapella discovered that an ancient strain of corn grown in a remote region of Oaxaca, Mexico, had been contaminated by Monsanto's Roundup Ready corn. That's even though Mexico did not allow the planting of GMO corn. In today's program, you will first hear from Schmeiser. He has become an expert in describing the dangerous ingredients that are inserted into the DNA of a seed that is engineered in the lab. Essential information in the current debate over mandatory labeling. He makes the case that coexistence between GMO and pure seeds is impossible because GMOs cannot be contained. Later, Ignacio Chapella will talk about the risks of engineering microbes and animals. This is important background information for projects such as salmon engineered with growth hormones that biotech corporations are gaining approval for as this program goes to air in February 2012. Percy Schmeiser.
I'd like to go into two important issues. The issue of containment. Once you introduce GMOs, you cannot contain it. You cannot contain wind, pollen flow, or transportation, whatever, and it'll move. The other important issue, there is no such thing as coexistence. And the GMO gene is the dominant gene and spread into whatever species of seeds or plants that it gets into, and it becomes dominant. So you lose biodiversity, you lose your indigenous seeds, pure seeds, heirloom seeds, and so on. So there is no such thing as coexistence. You no longer have choice. And I think up till about 2 years ago, organic farmers didn't realize how serious the situation was with the introduction of GMOs, that they could wake up tomorrow morning and not realize that they're no longer an organic farmer or a conventional farmer, and especially if your seeds and plants are taken away on you. So no coexistence and no containment. There's also the issue of terminator genes, which is now the real hot issue on the northern plains and the prairies of western Canada, where the Monsanto now wants to introduce the terminator gene. Before that, it was Delta and Pine Company Limited, where the seeds from a plant are now sterile, and you cannot use them the following year. And I think that's the greatest assault on life that we've ever seen on the face of this planet. Imagine a corporation coming out with a seed that is sterile, that you have no future life from it. The danger of that, it can also spread under certain conditions into your neighbor's crop and render his crop to some degree sterile also. Really, the name for it is GERTS, or Genetic Use Restriction Technology. That's GERTS, but The farmers have given it the name of the Terminator. And Monsanto has been trying very hard, especially in third world countries, to try to commercialize the Terminator gene. It has not been allowed in North America, and hopefully we can keep it not being allowed all over the world. So that's another very important issue. I won't go on too much longer, but the economic issue has been devastating. Farmers were told back on the Northern Plains and the prairies of Western Canada in 1996, increased yields, less chemicals, and more nutritious. We'd now be able to feed a hungry world. We'd now have sustainable agriculture. What has happened with the introduction of GMOs? The yields have gone down drastically in soybeans and canola. The nutritional content is only maybe 50% of what it was before. But most of all, we have a massive increased use of chemicals, of mutants that have developed, and superweeds. I mentioned before superweeds, and I'll explain what a superweed is. A superweed is a regular conventional canola plant. Monsanto was not the only company in 1996 to start selling GMO canola. You had other varieties like Liberty Link, Pursuit Smart, and Roundup Ready canola. Within the first year of the introduction, you had a cross-pollination of those three GMO canola crops into one regular conventional canola plant, now taking a multitude of chemicals to try and kill that new superweed. The superweed is not only in canola fields now, it has spread into our wheat fields, our barley fields, into our towns, our road allowances, our golf courses, our cemeteries. It is all over now, a new added expense for everyone with this new superweed. Now they have come out with a new, more powerful, a highly toxic chemical to try and control the new superweed. So what has this all meant to us? It's meant a control of the seed supply and a massive use and of new chemicals and more powerful chemicals and more chemicals. More danger to the environment and harm to the environment and human health. I don't want to go on much longer, but one thing I would like to say, we now have two major results with the introduction of GMOs. First of all, the GMOs themselves, the harm to human health, and the increased use of chemicals. Now, Monsanto this past year had to release to the British government their own testing on their herbicide Roundup. Monsanto used to say in North America, Roundup was so safe, it was safer than table salt, you could even drink it. But what did Monsanto's own testing reveal, and which they had to produce for the British government, was this. First of all, it's a blood disruptor, which means increased rates of tumors, cancer-causing tumors, especially in young people, in growing organs. Number two, it lowers a human's immune system. Number three, kidney and liver ailments. Number four, rashes and eczemas. This is what Monsanto's own testing revealed to the British government when they were telling us all the while it was safe. I won't go into the environmental, but I would like to say one thing on the food issue. When you transfer a gene from one life form to another, you can never move that gene by itself. You have to use a promoter or vector. And what are these promoters or vectors? They are either a bacteria or a virus. In the case of canola, antibiotic-resistant marker gene. So when you eat a GMO food, you're not only eating a gene that prevents that plant from dying if you spray Roundup on it, but you're eating a virus or a bacteria that was never in your food before. So again, I'd like to close this way. My wife and I are very concerned, especially because of the fact that we have 5 children of our own, we have 15 grandchildren. What kind of a legacy are we going to leave? And all of us leave to our children and our grandchildren, a legacy of land and air and water full of poisons. And I think none of us want that kind of legacy. Back in 1996, we didn't know what could happen with the introduction of GMOs. At least you have that knowledge. And the choice that you make here will be your choice. And down the road, you cannot say, we didn't know. So always remember that when you introduce it into any plant, most plants come from a family of plants. It will spread into that family. Canola comes from the brassica family. and it's already spread to radishes, turnips, cauliflower, and so on. Remember, in closing, there is no return. You introduced GMOs, and it's over. Again, it's a great pleasure to come to California and bring you this message. I've spent a lot of time in California in the last 5 years, as well as other parts around the world. And as long as my wife and I have life in us, we gave a commitment back in 1998 that we would always stand up and we would go down fighting for the rights of farmers, always to use their seed from year to year. If you give up that right, you're back to a feudal and a serf system. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That was the Canadian farmer Percy Schmeiser speaking to a group of organic farmers and gardeners in Mendocino County, California. He had helped campaign for a local county ordinance, the first passed in the U.S., that banned the use of GMO seeds and animals. Schmeiser was accompanied by the UC Berkeley microbiologist Ignacio Chapella. Chapella was initially denied tenure when he disclosed that Monsanto GMO corn had contaminated the cradle of corn in the remote region of Oaxaca, Mexico. Chapella has become a dedicated and very well-informed campaigner against the engineering of life. For him, it has become apparent that GMO canola, corn, soy, and other plants are part of a failed technology, and he has moved on to a question that very few are asking yet. Can genetically engineered plants and animals not only make us sick when we eat them, but can there be a horizontal gene transfer between their genes and ours, since our genes are related? Are we modifying the human DNA as we modify the related DNA of our relatives, the plants and animals? Here's Ignacio Chapella.
We have 30 years of experience with this now. And I think with the 30 years of experience, the four crops that Percy pointed out, the two traits that continue to be the mainstay of the industry, which are herbicide resistance and insecticide production by these plants, the BT, so-called BT toxin manipulation, we know that that generation of GMOs is pretty much bankrupt. And I think I say that confidently. It is bankrupt biologically. It's a bad idea, doesn't work. It is bankrupt environmentally. The application of chemicals continues to increase. Some of these herbicides like atrazine are banned in Europe. Since 2003, at least, the BBC documented Monsanto having to sell something called Roundup AZ. And the little AZ stood for atrazine. So we've gone back to chemistries that are really bad for the environment. So biologically, it's bankrupt. Environmentally, it's bankrupt. Financially, it's bankrupt, at least since 1999, certainly by 2000. Anybody who knew anything on this field was pulling their money away from it, putting it quietly somewhere else. Socially, as Percy showed, we have sown a lot more social damage than any benefits that we could have accrued from it. And hunger hasn't gotten any better. We don't need any more biomass. We burn our food in our gasoline tanks. We use our food to pack, you know, those biodegradable noodles, the noodles that you use for packing. They are biodegradable, they're nice and cool because they're biodegradable, but what they are, they're Cheetos without the flavor. They're puffed up corn starch. So we use food to pack stuff, we use food to burn, and yet hunger hasn't gone away. So that was not where it was at. So that one generation of genetically modified organisms, which continues to be pushed to the rest of the world, there are new developments that are very hard to track and that will be very difficult to get people to become energized by. One of them, to me the most important one probably, is the manipulation of microorganisms. Microorganisms and, of course, trees, fish, insects. This manipulation, it's not a technology, it's simply a manipulation, a fiddling with living things. This fiddling with them is so easy to do. the methods that were developed back in 72, 75, the early 80s, are so easy to apply that anybody in this room can do it in their backyard. So as many people as have their hands on this, there are so-called products or new ideas of what could be developed. And those ideas are all over the place, phylogenetically, taxonomically. So while we're talking about agriculture, while we're talking about food and crops, we should be really aware that we're also talking by proxy, if you will, about all those developments. So what you did by, for example, by passing a resolution not to have environmentally released genetically modified organisms here, I'm sure most of you were thinking about corn and some grapevine and so on, but what you were also doing was slowing down and protecting your county from the introduction of all these other organisms that are not as sexy, if you will. They don't catch the attention of the media so much. But microbes, things that we don't see, are over 98% of the living world. That is where we are applying a lot of these manipulations. And there, the diversity of so-called products, the diversity of manipulations is really wide and really widespread, really hard to track. They are used for all kinds of applications, many of them very attractive. The idea, for example, of using genetically modified organisms for bioremediation, cleaning up oil spills, cleaning up mine tills, and so on, is something that I'm sure many in this audience will find it harder to oppose. And I just wanted you to know, not only hundreds of millions, but billions of dollars and growing, is the biofuel domain. And there are the production of trees with less lignin so that they can be broken down easily or more easily to produce ethanol. GMO trees, of course. The production of GMO grasses, the production of GMO microbes to break down these things. It's going to be really difficult to confront that new wave. It is here. It's not coming. It's right here. And I just wanted you to know, that's basically what I wanted to do. I just want you to know that there are those two fronts coming that will be a lot harder to fight with, because many of our environmentalist friends are so in love with this idea that you will find it difficult politically. I want to stop there because I wanted to hear from you. I think it'd be much better if you directed our discussions.
I have a question, and it's relating to the containment. You said it can't be contained and it does cross-pollinate. The question is, it seems that since it's moving to different species, is there any reason that it would not move to every species of plant and every species of animals, as if there is just no protection now that it's loose?
I want to say that as a biologist, I used to really cringe at the thought of this and people talking like this. Even though, basically speaking, yes, we are all connected in a very real way, because DNA is connected. And I think I changed a lot by doing some research for Measure M in Sonoma. I started reading about what people in the medical profession doing with vaccines. There is a way of vaccinating people and animals where you simply inject on an epithelium, either on your skin or inside, a DNA, just raw DNA. And that DNA is actually picked up by your cells, incorporated into your genome, and there is some expression locally of that that piece of DNA in your cells. I was really amazed to see that happening in mammals, in humans, because we have a lot of mechanisms to prevent that from happening. Imagine that we picked up any DNA floating around in the environment. We would start just expressing bacterial and plant traits, and you would start growing things on you. We have incredible, powerful policing mechanisms, if you will, molecular policing, within ourselves, within our tissues, in an organism, that are always making sure that we are what we say on the label that we are, right? And not something else that is coming in. Yet, it's a difficult job. And it's so difficult, actually, that we have viruses that we have to fight every year. Every year you get DNA incorporated into your cells every time you get a flu or you get any other viral diseases. Viruses are particularly good at that. It's not surprising that we should be using viral DNA. In all these GMO constructs, the way we get that DNA to stick, to actually stay within the corn plant, that the corn plant is also trying to stay a corn plant. Thank you very much. We use these pieces of DNA to stick, to shuttle the DNA that we want to foist upon the corn plant. And it works. The amazing thing is that it would work, and it works because we are piggybacking, hijacking the viral sequences. So it's not just any kind of DNA. It's DNA that is actually really promiscuous, and it will move around. Certainly, it will move into bacteria, and viruses will pick it up. This is DNA that will be easily picked up by bacteria and viruses. So bacteria and viruses will act as a channel. You know, they will come, pick up the DNA here, and will move on into another organism and pass that on. So your suspicion, kind of instinctually, I think has a lot more biological substance to it. And I do worry, I do care a lot about the fact that what we're doing is we are turning everything into virus. We're viralizing the biosphere, where it has taken very long evolutionary time to get to places where we have organisms that are really well determined and so on. For millions of years, we had life in the bacterial world and viral world that was not anywhere near what we consider to be normal world. And now we're kind of pushing evolution back to that place where DNA is a lot more promiscuous, where you have a lot more of this horizontal gene transfer, and we have no idea what the consequences are.
It's out there. It is like really sending something in motion that you have no power over, like nuclear power.
I think it's really important because it shows that something that you do in Iowa in a laboratory is going to sooner or later find its way to the Zapotec Mountains in Oaxaca. And by the same token, a little bit deeper, it's going to find its way to my genome. So the transformation of corn in an Iowa laboratory is, in a very real, physical, technical sense, a transformation of the human genome, admittedly a few generations down the line. But it's true that all genomes are connected in biology. You know, over evolutionary time, we are all connected in a very real sense, in a very physical sense. So it's not as trivial as it would seem. Yes, of course, if you are thinking of, you know, 1, 2, 10 generations of humans, that is not a problem. And then we say, well, it's a risk. You know, I'm going to go to Phil Campbell's level and talk about this movie Shrek, when you have the dictator say, and I'm going to send you to find my princess and fight for her. And of course, many of you are going to die, but it's a risk I'm willing to take. You know, it's the same position that we in this generation are very willing to take risks for 10 generations down the line. So who cares if they get contaminated with corn manipulations that were done in Iowa in 2002? I think there is a new sense of social justice that biotechnology brings that has to do with intergenerational responsibility that environmentalists had already established many years ago, but biotechnologists are establishing in a very real physical sense. The transformations of life that we're doing today are having major repercussions into the future. The question was, how could we see these manipulations of transgenic manipulations of DNA in other species come back to humans? And I see two ways. One, which is the biological route, which is totally speculative but not implausible and not unlikely. And that is a process called horizontal gene transfer. We know that we are connected with the rest of, you know, DNA-based, carbon-based life over evolutionary time. You know, when Haeckel and Darwin and those people were thinking of evolution, they used to think of evolution as a continuously expanding tree with branches always diverging away from each other. You have pure lines that are just always getting purer and purer and kind of diverging away from them. DNA work, this molecular biology knowledge has helped us realize that that's not really the case, the way evolution happens. There is a lot of what's called reticulation, where you have feedback, movement of genetic material from one of these branches to the other. So what we have is really a net of life, of interconnected life. The rate of movement is very low, especially for organisms like ourselves that are really good at telling self from non-self, and really good at pushing out bacteria that come into your body and so on. But, I mean, some of you might be surprised that you are actually, every one of your cells is actually made not of a cell that you can call, you know, pure Aryan or whatever your race might be, but it's actually made of your cells or the cells of your ancestors plus bacteria that have been incorporated into it through evolutionary time that you call your mitochondria. Those mitochondria really evolved from or are the descendants of a totally different evolutionary lineage than the other part of your ancestors, you know, so they met at some point. So there are roots through which we should expect over evolutionary time to see the interconnectedness of life operate like that. I think there are much better, much easier ways of thinking about this question, and that is how it is that we are using the technology to transform humans. But the technology itself denies the difference between humans and non-humans. That's the whole point of the technology. So there are incredible advances out there that are pointing to or are aiming at transforming the human genome by incorporating either pieces from other humans, but also pieces from other organisms, or producing pigs that will carry proteins, that human proteins or human genes, and express that. So we are trying, we are really working at erasing the difference between species in the lab.
That was University of California, Berkeley microbiologist and ecologist Ignacio Chapella, talking about the brave new future of genetically engineered organisms that may take us back in time in evolutionary history. He and Percy Schmeiser spoke to organic farmers in Ukiah, California in November 2006. Ignacio Chapella answered follow-up questions for me after the event. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. This program is also available as film on DVD. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.